Good morning. I'm Donna Quinn, and for the next half hour, you'll be listening to Talk of Our Towns. Today, I am honored to have in the studio Julian Smith. Julian is an award-winning writer specializing in travel and science. His articles and photographs have appeared in Smithsonian, Wired, Outside, National Geographic Traveler, New Scientist, Discover, The Los Angeles Times, The Washington Post, and U.S. News and World Report, among others. Julian's 2009 book, Crossing the Heart of Africa, which I read and is one of my favorite books, is about retracing the route of a love-struck British explorer across the continent. And it won awards from the Banff Mountain Festival Book Competition, the Society of American Travel Writers, and the American Society of Journalists and Authors. With degrees in biology and wildlife ecology, Julian helped launch and edit Frontiers in Ecology and the Environment, an international peer-reviewed scientific journal. He has written travel guidelines to El Salvador, Ecuador, Virginia, the Four Corners, and Portland, Oregon, and he's taught writing, editing, and literature at the Gotham Writers Workshop and the College of Santa Fe. He's a very busy young man, and he currently lives in Portland, Oregon, with his wife and daughters. Hi, Julian.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm thrilled to have you here in Astoria, Oregon today.
Well, it's a great place to visit.
It is, and I want to hear your perspective on Astoria and Portland, and we'll talk about that a little later, but first, please, let's talk about your background, about where you grew up and how you jumped into the world of travel writing.
Well, I grew up in New York, about an hour north of New York City, and went to college in Virginia, University of Virginia. And I was always interested in travel. I was lucky enough that my parents always took me on trips for as long as I can remember, really. And I was always really interested in writing, too. I love writing, I love reading, I love books. And so I was lucky enough to be able to put them together right after college. I hooked up with a partner, and we embarked on this crazy venture to write a guidebook to El Salvador. With no funding, no publisher, no nothing. We just, for some reason, decided to do it. And
did you speak Spanish?
Not really at that point. So it was a real learning experience in every sense of the word.
Hubris of youth.
So we wrote the book. We learned how to lay it out on a computer. We took the pictures, and we found a distributor and got it out there. It was called On Your Own in El Salvador. So we basically launched a miniature publishing company on our own. And so once you have a book in hand, then you can actually talk to real publishers and say, hey, I've done this. I'd like to do more books. So I hooked up with Moon Publications, who do a lot of travel guidebooks around the world and the U.S. And so for them, I did a guidebook to Ecuador and to Virginia and then to the Four Corners of the Southwest. And then I just kept moving west more and more. I just always kind of felt the call to go west. And so yeah, I lived over the years in Utah, in New Mexico twice, and eventually ended up in Portland when there wasn't any farther west to go.
That's true. This is the furthest. Even though we're the Northwest, we're still really the West West. And of course, that story, because it was the first U.S. settlement west of the Rockies. And that history is so crucial. And you feel that here in Astoria. So you've traveled around the world, and you traveled at a time when maybe travel was not as fraught with danger. I mean, there were different kinds of dangers, right? I mean, how is travel today, in your opinion, internationally, as opposed to when you were a young man traveling around and doing these kinds of trips?
Well, honestly, I don't think it's changed that much. I think we're maybe more aware of the risks, but I'm not sure that I would say the risks are greater. You know, the 24-hour news cycle makes everything seem worse than it is. And, you know, the U.S. State Department is always giving warnings about going here and there. And I know there are a few places that you really don't want to go at this point. Some of them I've been to, and just you have to be extra vigilant. But you know, 99% of the places to go out there, I don't think anything's really changed.
So after you'd written some of these travel publications, you wound up in Portland, Oregon.
Right.
And let's talk about the genesis of how did Crossing the Heart of Africa come to be?
Well, I was looking for a book topic. I wanted to do a real, quote-unquote, real book, not a travel guide, although they're all a lot of work. And so I found a mention of this explorer, Grogan, in a completely different book, a book about psychology, I think. And it was talking about the lengths that men will go to impress women. And it just had this one paragraph mention of this guy who crossed Africa in 1899, basically to prove to his girlfriend's parents that he was worth marrying. And I thought, wow, I gotta track this guy down. So I did a little digging, and I found he actually wrote a book about it that I found a copy in the University of Virginia library and read it. And I've read a lot of these kind of old travel accounts, and a lot of times they're pretty dry and dusty. But this guy's book is different. He has a real wicked sense of humor. It's just a real readable account. It's kind of, you just actually sit down. You don't have to really plow through. So I just started digging and digging. And then at the same time, I had my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, and our relationship was progressing. And I kind of saw some of these parallels between my relationship and his. He was wooing a rich heiress in New Zealand. And basically this woman's stepfather said, well, you want to marry my stepdaughter? What makes you more worthy than the 100 other guys who would like to also? And Grogan hadn't really done much up to his life until then, but he had big aspirations. So he said, how about if I become the first person to walk the entire length of Africa from south to north, which nobody has ever done? And the stepfather said, sure, if you can do that. He pretty much thought he was sending him off to die. But Grogan pulled it off. And I saw this parallel between my progression towards marriage with my wife, Laura, and this guy, Grogan. And so I was able to combine them. I went off on a trip. She agreed to the proposal but the condition was I had to be back a month before we got married. So I spent 2 of the 3 months before we got married in Africa alone, traveling about 4,000 miles on buses and motorcycles, planes, boats, and they eventually came together and I wrote a book about it.
Yes, and I love that book. It's because what's great is you learn about the actual original voyage. How old was Grogan when he did this?
He was in his early 20s. So he was
and he knew nothing at that time. I mean, today, I guess you can say, oh, I've got my phone, I can figure out, this is roads closure, but he had no idea what he was doing.
No, he went to places that Europeans had never even been to in Central Africa. And I mean, the things he faced, he was tossed into a tree by an elephant in the jungle. He was literally chased by cannibals at certain points. And he just had this incredible adventure. And he was completely cut off from the outside world, too. There was no way to even let Gertrude, his would-be wife, know that he was okay for 2 years. He just disappeared. And he said, I'm not going to contact you until and if I make it all the way to Cairo. And that's what he did.
And what you've done in the book, which I really appreciated too, because you're an excellent writer, I appreciated the fact that I was in Grogan's journey for a chapter, and then I was in your journey. And you were comparing and contrasting because things were so different then. So you weren't chased by cannibals.
No, not this time. No. I always love to compare the past to the present. And that was one of the more interesting parts of the trip for me, to see some of these same places that he saw and described so well 100 years before. A lot of the landscape is obviously the same. Culturally, some things are the same. Some things are different. It's obviously not quite as dangerous as it was when he was there. But, you know, some places I still couldn't go 100 years later, like the Eastern Congo he went into. And that was actually where the cannibal thing happened. And when I was there, that was a no-go zone. So I had to bypass that. I made it as far as southern Sudan, which was the very end of his journey, which came very, very close to killing him. And I spent a few days there. And back then, it was not a good place to be. So I ended up actually saying, this is as far as I'm going to go. This is the limit.
It was a spiritual journey as well as a journey of physical hardship and exploration. I mean, this was a pilgrimage for you in a way.
Yeah, it was. In a way, I think looking back on it, I kind of see it as, I don't want to say the last hurrah before getting married, but now that we are married and have two young girls, I don't think I'm going to be taking off for 2 months at a time to go cross a continent anytime soon, which is great. But at the time, it felt like something I had to almost get out of my system before settling down.
Well, there are different kinds of journeys. And then you wrote Smoke Jumper. Why don't you tell us about Smoke Jumper?
Well, Smoke Jumper is the story of a smoke jumper, nonfiction. He's a guy, Jason Ramos. He lives up in northern Washington. He's at the North Cascade Smoke Jumper base up there. And this is basically his story of growing up as a firefighter in different ways and then becoming a smoke jumper. And it tells about the job, which not many people know about or know exactly what goes into it and how incredibly difficult it is and what an important service these guys and women provide. There's only a few hundred of them in the country at any one time. It's unbelievably difficult what they do, parachuting into the absolute middle of nowhere, just a few of them, a handful at a time, trying to put out these small fires before they come big. And it saves the country millions of dollars by snuffing these things out when they're small. but the adventures Jason has had, the challenges he's faced, it was a really eye-opening book to write.
And both of these books, Crossing the Heart of Africa, An Odyssey of Love and Adventure, and Smoke Jumper, a memoir by one of America's most select airborne firefighters, are available at our local bookstores. And you are now working on another book.
I'm putting together a proposal, yes. Okay. I'll keep the subject tight-lipped at the moment, but I have high hopes for it. It's going to be a funny one this time, I think.
And you are living currently in Portland with your wife and your two daughters, and you are writing for a lot of different publications. You're writing for, when I looked at some of the articles on your website, and it's a great website, by the way, if you want to visit, it's juliansmith.com. He's a writer living in Portland and with a focus on science. And some of the articles you've written, I'd love to read some of these. And I read a couple online. The AC of Tomorrow, Tapping Deep Water for Cooling. Dolphin-inspired man-made fin works swimmingly. The Science of Grave Robbing. Heliskiing in Sun Valley, Africa's New Poaching Police. Galapagos Rising. You have traveled extensively, and you've written about a lot of different things. Is there something that is your passion now that you just...
Well, my background is in biology and wildlife ecology. I got my master's degree studying grizzly bears off of the coast of BC. So, you know, obviously animals, landscapes, it's such a broad range. There's so much out there. It's amazing. Living in New Mexico and Utah, I fell in love with the Rocky Mountains. The Southwest Desert is probably my favorite place to be. But, you know, I'm lucky enough to work for enough different publications that there's almost always somebody who will give me an assignment about something that I find interesting. And that's kind of the curse of being a freelancer is everything is interesting. And so, I mean, it's a curse and a blessing, too. You know, just for example, last year I wrote about, speaking of Africa, I went to Tanzania and spent a few days with a tribe of hunter-gatherers out there in northern Tanzania that the Nature Conservancy is trying to get their land, get them official title to their land. So, you know, I was out at sunrise for 3 days in a row with these guys with bows and arrows trying to literally hunt what they're going to eat during the day. And 2 months later, I'm up in Banff and following a tracking dog through the woods with scientists who are trying to do wildlife surveys with these highly trained dogs who sniff out animal poop basically all day. There's a training center in Washington called Conservation Canines, and they take these really highly strung dogs from rescue adoption centers that basically are too high energy, too high strung for people to adopt, who are probably going to get euthanized. But it turns out that makes them absolutely perfect for this job of sniffing out different kinds of animal poop all day, every day, for weeks and months on end. And as long as every time they find it, they get 10 or 15 seconds to play with the red rubber ball. And it's almost like this canine OCD, but they love it, and they'll do it all day as long as they get the ball.
And the purpose of them doing that is?
Is for wildlife biologists to be able to get information on what animals are out there, where they are, how they're doing. They can get DNA evidence from their scat. They can find out if they're stressed, if they're being poisoned by anything. So it's a great job in that it takes you a lot of places, and you're constantly learning. And that's what I love about it.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Talk of Our Towns. I'm your host, Donna Quinn, and today in the studio, I have Julian Smith. He is an award-winning writer specializing in travel and science. He also has two books. He's written Crossing the Heart of Africa and Smoke Jumper, a memoir by one of America's most select airborne firefighters. And we've been talking about some of your journeys. I mean, it's a completely different kind of journey to be a parent and have two young girls.
Absolutely.
That is something, and we were talking about that. There are no guidebooks. Even if you can read all the parenting books in the world, each child is so different. Each dynamic is so different. That's a very different kind of journey.
It is, yeah. And it makes crossing Africa look like a birthday party sometimes.
That's so interesting you said that, because I went to a lecture by a mountaineer, and he was a survivor in there was a terrible avalanche, and he was thought to be dead, and he had just a terrible adventure. And at the end of the day, though, he said that coming back and trying to work, fitting back into his life with his wife and his children, that was harder than anything that he experienced in the external world. Because, again, it's relationships. And I'm sure when you have traveled, making connections with local people everywhere. That's got to have been a key part of your journey.
Yeah, you do get to meet a lot of different interesting people, whether you're in Canada or Tanzania. That's always one of the highlights of it, I think. And for me, one of the things I've always loved about traveling the most is not just the traveling part, the going away, but also the coming back at the end, because I feel like it makes you appreciate your life a lot more if you're able to actually step outside it for a little bit, especially if you're traveling in places where people aren't as lucky as you are. And it might be a difficult place to be, a difficult place to travel, but you still meet interesting people. You still meet wonderful people who will, you know, go out of their way to help you out, just to show you their lives. And then being able to come back and appreciate in a new way what you actually have, whether it's your home, your job, your family. I always find that one of the most rewarding parts of being a travel writer.
Yeah, and that is part of the beauty of people leaving their known comfortable world and really exposing themselves to different cultures, different experiences where they are discomforted, and you see things in a new way.
Right.
You mentioned earlier that you were shifting more toward more science and conservation writing. Let's talk about that. Why do you think that shift is happening?
Well, partly it's a financial decision. Everybody wants to be a travel writer, so there's a lot more competition in that world. And a lot of the outlets are not quite drying up, but it's becoming harder to do. It was easier to do when I was in my 20s, 20 years ago. And it's fun, I got to say. It's got some great perks. You know, I've been to the Galapagos Islands probably 4 times now. I've been able to do some really incredible things as a travel writer. But I find the science and conservation writing more interesting. There's more to learn. You actually feel like you're possibly making a difference by letting people know what's going on. It seems a little more meaningful, I would say, than a lot of travel writing. Although you can have travel writing that actually accomplishes a purpose at the same time too. I think some of it does. But as opposed to the what I call the fun stuff, where, you know, I went there, I did this, it was great, you should do it too, which has a place. You know, I still do some of it myself. But when I'm able to, you know, tell people how a tribe in Africa is struggling to get legal title to their lands, or, you know, these amazing conservation projects, or these technical breakthroughs I'm writing about for Intel, or things like that, I guess the word is a little more meaty now.
Yes, it's meaningful. And I think also you have a perspective, since you've traveled so much, it's hard for people to appreciate that maybe, you know, the glaciers are melting unless you actually have seen it.
Right.
Unless you've
right.
experienced some of that.
Right.
So because of your ability to compare and contrast things, mm-hmm. how is it living in Portland now? And what do you think about Astoria?
I love Oregon. I love Portland. My wife and I spent 3 years in Santa Fe before coming here, which is a really interesting place. Beautiful. But we decided to move to Portland basically because we'd heard so many great things about it. We're both actually freelancers, self-employed. My wife works for a documentary TV and film. She's a producer. And so we were ready to get out of Santa Fe, and we were looking for a city out west that was not too big, not too small, had a vibrant local culture. And we visited Portland. We said, this is it. So we actually got married. We moved here, and we have had our 2 daughters here. Both of our parents have moved here. All our in-laws live here now, and we love it. I mean, I've lived a lot of places in my life. I've bounced around a lot, and I have to say Portland is probably the first place in a long time that actually feels like home. Hmm. It feels like not just a temporary place. And I just love how there's so many different things to do and places to see within such close range. I mean, within the past 2 weeks, we went to the beach, we went skiing in the mountains. And, you know, there's places like Astoria, which are just full of history and funky little towns that I just love to come out and spend a couple days in. You know, great food, great things to see, pop out to the beach. I love that there's so much here so close, and there's such a wide variety.
One of the things I appreciate about Oregon, and one of the reasons that I have made it my home state, is because of the land use laws. Because I love Idaho. However, when I go there and I see gorgeous farming and ranch country chopped into tiny little half-acre parcels, maybe with a little mobile home on each one, and they're not protecting not only their scenic vistas, their view sheds, but the land that can grow crops. It's being developed, and I think that Oregon was very progressive, not only with the beach bill, but also with these land use laws, so that, you know, you do have water and land being protected in ways that I don't see it protected in some other states.
Yes. Yeah, it's definitely a progressive state. Portland is probably the pinnacle of progressiveness. I think it's to the point of self-parody sometimes. But yeah, it's you know, for example, it's great to go to the coast here and know that nobody's ever going to build a mansion there and keep people off the beach. It's just you wherever you go here, you feel that sense of wanting to keep what we have, which is amazing.
Yes, it is. It's true. In your travel now around the West and the Northwest, and I guess you're actually traveling out of the country as well, too. You're not taking long trips because your daughters would say, come on, Dad, you can't leave for so long.
Unless they come with me.
Okay, that's a good thing. Are you seeing evidence of a lot of change that concerns you? And is that why another reason why maybe you're also focusing on the science writing, too, and the conservation writing?
Well, yeah, some places, I mean, places inevitably change, sometimes for the worse, sometimes for the better. But yeah, I do, when you travel a lot over a long period of time, yeah, you do see changes. You know, I was first in Ecuador, which is one of my favorite places, when I was in my early 20s. And, you know, I've been there as recently as a couple years ago. And you see changes, not just, you know, an internet cafe on every corner. But, you know, places like the Galapagos, which they're trying to do a really difficult job of protecting while also bringing hundreds of thousands of tourists a year to visit it. It's a really tough balance to strike. I think they're doing a pretty good job of it, but they certainly have their work cut out for them. Or even like a place like Cuba, which I've been to a couple times. I was there actually on 9/11, which was an interesting place to be. And I was most recently there a couple years ago, and just seeing the changes that place is going through. It's, you know, it's about to open up again to Americans, you know, for the first time since the 50s. And that place is really going to change. And it's going to be great for the people. As a traveler, it's kind of a mixed bag, because it's definitely one of the most unique places I've been, the most in an enjoyable way. At the same time, you realize that it's the fact that it's cut off that makes it so unique. So if it goes back to being another Atlantic City in the Caribbean, you know, that'll be good for a lot of people, but in a way that something will also be lost too that makes it unique.
I think that's a real dilemma, is how do communities preserve the character, the very fiber of their communities when you have a lot of tourism, and what is sustainable, and when does it really start to erode, you know, the actual character and uniqueness of that particular place?
Right. Just by looking at something, you change it, or by being there, which
right.
is kind of the inherent contradiction of traveling. And all you can do is try to minimize it and just accept that that's part of the process. I mean, even you're seeing it happen in Portland now. You know, we've been in Portland for 8 years, and we've, you know, already become one of those people who say, you know, oh, it was different back then. You know, we didn't have this and this. So, you know, a lot of the changes are for the better. You know, the small business opportunities are really expanding. There's more people in our professions, more people to interact with. At the same time, it's becoming almost impossible to buy a house in certain areas. It's, you know, it hasn't quite jumped the shark yet, but you can see the shark around the corner. There's so many more tourists now. It's definitely changing, you know, but it's always, almost always is for the best, for the better and for the worse in some ways.
That's true. I don't know that you can have it both ways. I mean, you'd get, if you live in a beautiful place or a place where people want to be, there's a particular lifestyle quality. Something's going to happen. Something's going to change. It just is inevitable. We only have a few minutes left, Julian. What other things would you like the listening audience to know about either any of the articles that you think are important that you've written, or observations that you have, or reflections, or maybe even call to actions? I know that a lot of people who live in Oregon aren't even familiar that there's this amazing place called the Owyhees here, which are hopefully going to be protected as wilderness, because that's a very rare kind of jewel in our state. But is there anything else you'd like the listening audience to know, either about your work or in general from your travels?
Well, I would have to say get out as much as possible and travel as much as possible, which is kind of a something we're trying to instill in our girls as well, and take them as many places as we can as soon as possible. But, you know, just keep an eye out for the people. The people is always where the story is when you're in a different place. And it's always the small stories that really make the difference. For example, one of the pieces I worked on last year for an online magazine called Epic is, we called it The Cold War. And it's about two ice cream truck drivers in Salem who have had this years-long ongoing feud. One is this guy, Dennis, big guy, talks a lot. He's really into it for the kind of Americana aspect of it. And the other guy is named Ephraim, and he's an immigrant from Mexico who works his butt off all day, every day. And for various reasons, these guys came into conflict about territory and who could sell where. So it's a funny story with two great characters. But at the same time, it shows you people have these very different lives and things that might seem small to you. I mean, who thinks of ice cream truck drivers, really, besides, oh, there goes the ice cream truck. But it means so much to people who are doing it. And it's, you know, it's all relative, really. And it was amazing to kind of delve into this world and realize, you know, on one hand, this is a great story. It's funny, but it's also it's these guys' world, and it means everything to them. And it's just always a good thing to be reminded of, I think. People's lives are different from yours.
And yes, to look for the story. I think Mark Twain said travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness.
That's one of my favorite quotes.
Yes, so being open to how other people live their lives, and maybe then we wouldn't have this idea that we're right, they're wrong, and people would be more tolerant, more accepting, more open-mindedness.
Yeah, I always wonder about what percent of these people who are calling to, you know, for example, to build a wall on the Mexican border, how many of them have actually been to Mexico, you know, and talk to people who live there and see what life is like there and see, you know, why they want to come. You know, this guy Ephraim, one of the Cold War truck drivers, he crossed the border twice just to come to the U.S., just for the opportunities that were here. Left family behind, raised a new family here, and just hearing his story of literally walking across the desert on Christmas Eve, evading the border patrol, you think people are that determined to come here for what we have, and why would we not welcome them?
Issues are so complex today, and the news, we get these little bites. We don't get all. So researching, I know you're a great researcher, is something that we can all do and learn more about things so that we understand them in context. Because so many things are out of context. But Julian, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So grateful. Fun. I'm glad you like Astoria. We love living in Astoria, yeah. and in Oregon in general. And thank you for your perspective on life, for your wonderful writing, and for encouraging us to open our minds and look at things in new ways and look for those small stories.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been
great. Thank you so much. Thanks to all of you who listen to Talk of Our Towns, and I appreciate so much Kathleen Morgane, who was our engineer today, and local talented banjo instructor Michael Bruin for his original theme music for this program. Until next week, find a moment today. Take a deep breath. Relaxes your whole body, and then focus on those things which are working well in your life with gratitude. There will always be those things which aren't working well. Focus on the things that are. And then give yourself a loving and compassionate hug or a pat on the back for being uniquely you, for doing the best you can, and for being here now in the only moment which exists, the now moment, on the amazing planet we call Earth.